The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, in which we answer your questions. I, along with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who's a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition. Hi, Layla, how are you?
Hi, great, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good, good. So, lots of stuff in the news this week. We'll be answering questions. By the way to get questions to us is via radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. And, of course, the big news this week, the Ebola epidemic continues to rage, and now we have cases in the United States, and it's a big mess. And, you know, I'm not looking forward to what we're going to have to undergo as more and more people come down with sneezing and sniffles and fevers this fall, because now with Ebola in the picture, everybody's going to think the worst. People are going to jump to conclusions. There'll be mass panic. They'll say, get the flu shot. It's your duty to get the flu shot, because we don't want people to get the flu, because we're going to, you know, it'll tie up our medical resources sorting things out, because deciding whether people have Ebola or whether people have the flu. It's a big mess. And, one of the things that really kind of upset me is there's an NBC correspondent, medical correspondent. She's a doctor. I think she has a background as a surgeon. Her name is Dr. Nancy Schneiderman. And she recently, this was last week, she recently caught a lot of flack because she, with a crew, was in Africa, and she was exposed to an NBC cameraman who came down with Ebola. And so when the NBC crew came back to the United States, they said, you're going to be on lockdown. But they did not enforce the lockdown. They said, this is a voluntary lockdown. And so what did she do? She was spotted sitting in the back of her Mercedes while an assistant ran into a local eatery to get some takeout soup for her. And, she thought that she was going to do this on the QT, but she was spotted, and then she was outed. And then she made sort of a weasel word mea culpa, saying members of my crew violated the quarantine. But she didn't refer to herself, she being the physician and who should know better. But I got to tell you, I've always thought that there's a certain hauteur about her. There's a certain arrogance about Nancy Schneiderman.
Maybe that's how she got the job.
Well, I guess you got to have a lot of you got to have a lot of drive to get to the top. You know, claw your way to the top of the media empire there and become the medical correspondent, the chief medical correspondent for NBC News. But I have to remember, and I guess her misfortune causes me to have a little Schadenfreude. You know what Schadenfreude is? It's joy in the sufferings. Joy in the sufferings of others. Go see the musical Avenue Q, because there's a song called Schadenfreude. It's a great German word, which means joy in the suffering of others. And the reason that I have Schadenfreude is because 2 years ago she made a very, very sweeping pronouncement that, based on the latest research, people don't need to take supplements, because a healthy, balanced diet should take care of our nutritional needs, and supplements are a waste of time and money, and besides, they're unregulated and dangerous. And she made this statement on national TV, and I wanted to jump through the TV screen and strangle her.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah. So,
oh, my goodness.
So now she is now, shall we say, she has not distinguished herself in this episode, because as a medical professional, and, you know, I try to say, you know, what would I do in that situation? Because they say, well, you know, it's a voluntary thing. You know, you take your temperatures and you're fine, you know, and you say, well, what's the big deal here? I still would say, look, A, I'm a medical professional and I have to lead by example. And B, I'm a very visible media spokesperson if I had that job over at NBC. And if I would not take the chance that somehow I might be spotted, because that just goes to her credibility. I mean, she said she took a vow that she would be part of this quarantine.
Yeah.
And then she violated it. And so what is it when she makes pronouncements on the air, when she says, oh, you know, Ebola, no problem, it's going to be contained, you know, what's her credibility? And what's her credibility when she reports on other medical stories? Because she has shown a certain deceptiveness and deviousness in this particular case. I wonder if she will be, if they're going to circle wagons and keep her on at NBC, if we're gradually they're going to, you know.
Well, at this point, it appears she's a liability.
Yes, exactly.
So
I would say so. I would say so. But, you know, sometimes, you know, like in the Obama administration, sometimes there are people who are criticized and they just circle the wagons, you know, and they push back against any kind of criticism. You know, maybe NBC will say, no, you know, we didn't know. It was a little miscalculation, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a big deal.
It is a very big deal.
Same thing with a nurse who traveled. There's a nurse who traveled. You know, she was supposed to be on quarantine. They said she possibly had been exposed, so she was told to stay home and not go out. And instead, she jumped on a plane, potentially exposing 70 other passengers to Ebola. She had a low-grade fever at the time, she now admits. And so, selfishly, she put so many people at risk and maybe risked triggering a major outbreak of this.
Exactly.
Because it's just a lack of, selfishness and lack of discipline, which I think...
Or maybe a feeling of invincibility.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen to me. This is
exactly
still what happens to other people.
Exactly.
We call this adolescent syndrome or something.
Yeah,
you know?
You know, it can't happen here. It can't happen to me.
Right.
And so I think, unfortunately, America's being dealt a little bit of a lesson in vulnerability because... while we're not the deepest, darkest Africa, we still, there's a potential for problems. Anyway, hopefully it'll be easily snuffed out. You had a little comment on an acupuncture story that you wanted to share with us?
Yeah, we got an email from somebody. His name is Rafi. I think he sent you, he tweeted about you. Anyway.
Racy? Racy?
Yeah, Rafi.
Oh, Rafi, like Raphael Rafi.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
I read an article that says acupuncture is mostly placebo.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really true?
Okay.
And he sent us the link to the article. Dr. Hoffman, they are claiming that current evidence suggests that acupuncture is a placebo treatment. I'm just reading from the article here. The efficacy, approximately 50% of patients will experience relief of pain.
Right.
And the magnitude of relief is variable.
I saw the study, and you know what they do. You know, acupuncture is very hard to study because there's an enormous placebo effect when you get acupuncture. So what they do sometimes to study acupuncture is they will tell the practitioner who's administering. First of all, they have to have trained practitioners administering the acupuncture, but as a control, they'll tell the practitioners to put the needles in the wrong places.
So sham acupuncture.
It's called sham acupuncture. So that's the placebo. So with a drug or with a herb, it's pretty easy. You use a placebo pill, like a sugar capsule versus an active ingredient capsule. So that's that's easy. But with acupuncture, it's hard to do the studies. So what they did is they did sham acupuncture. So a couple of observations. One is you can't double blind this study. Double-blind placebo-controlled trial is where both the patient and the tester or the physician does not know whether there's an active ingredient or not. Now, clearly, the patient may not know that their active acupuncture is being undertaken, but the acupuncturist for sure knows. And there may be some subtle communication that occurs between the acupuncturist and the patient when sham acupuncture is going on. But what that should do is that actually should make it more clear that sham acupuncture is not as effective because there might be some sort of, I don't know, like a bad vibe.
We pick up more communication via body language and gesture and nuance and expressions.
Right.
That has to be happening.
So here's my assessment is that, first of all, there's no question that acupuncture is effective. Let's just put that let's just stipulate that. Acupuncture is effective for dealing with many pain syndromes and many conditions. And, of course, it was part of a major healing system that wasn't a bogus healing system in China for literally millennia, for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, there are limits to its effectiveness. You know, if you broke a bone, you know, you couldn't just do acupuncture and the bone would just, you know, heal all up. Or if you developed some terrible plague, like, you know, so many plagues occurred in the history of mankind, and you just did a like acupuncture, people probably still died. But for a certain number of indications for certain health problems, particularly pain-related problems, energetic problems, even problems like irregular menstrual cycles, infertility, lowered immunity, these problems seem to be helped by acupuncture. Now, it's very mysterious what goes on with acupuncture because it doesn't happen on a clear material level. We don't quite understand that. You know, when we use a drug, we see a chemical reaction that we can study in organic chemistry or in physiology in medical school. With acupuncture, what exactly is happening? Well, we know that there's some, you know, nerve impulses that are transmitted. Maybe some endorphins are created. Part of that is some kind of relaxation response that speaks to the immune system.
Yeah.
So what if it is a placebo? That doesn't mean that it's not a valuable therapy. The placebo is a very, very healing part of medicine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I never knowingly administer a placebo to patients, sort of cynically saying, look, I know this isn't going to work, but I'm going to give it to the patient and say, look, this is the pill that's going to cure your disease. I have belief in the procedures and remedies that I use for patients. But at the same time, and you know this, Layla, is that a lot of what happens at the Hoffman Center is people go on a healing path. They suddenly come to us in a state of confusion and disarray and sometimes hopelessness and despair, and then they get a coherent plan and they are engaged in the plan. They are involved in the plan. And every day and every way in their mind, they're doing something to augment their health. And that may send a signal to their immune system or to the body's reparative mechanisms for healing. And that's very important. And I think that's an element that's lacking in medicine because doctors, you know, look, stare into computer screens and they write prescriptions and there's no emotional exchange or encouragement sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important part of healing. And I know that this is a lot of what you and I do in our practice, and not just merely because our remedies are valuable, but part of it is administered in the proper way.
Yes.
There's a healing response.
Rather than operating anymore from helplessness and disarray, they're now operating from a place of power, and I think that's one of the things that we are able to give them, given their particular regimen.
Right. And, you know, the placebo effect certainly extends to pharmaceutical drugs. So, for example, when people take antidepressants, there's a very strong placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also something called the compliance effect. Is people who do anything with instructions, whether it's they, eat a certain way or exercise a certain way or take pills on a regular basis, whether they're vitamins and supplements or whether they're medicinal pills, the compliance effect actually helps people get better. So that it's akin to the placebo effect, but it's just, you know, the getting into a process by which you feel there's a healing path is a very important part of healing. And acupuncture is, I think it's a wonderful way to invoke that. I think acupuncture, you know, doesn't make sense for certain things, and I sometimes see it used for indications that I, you know, not that enthused about. But in many mm-hmm. cases, I refer patients to acupuncture, and we refer patients
to acupuncture, sure.
And I'm trained in acupuncture. Of course, at this point, mm-hmm. my acupuncture training, I think, is so many years behind me, and I have so little practice that I say, hey, you know, there's great acupuncturists here in New York City. There's so many. Why don't you go see someone who does acupuncture on, 40 patients a week and is really on their game and to get the best results?
Definitely.
So that's my take on it. I don't think that study matters very much.
I don't think so either.
Yep.
Okay. We have a patient from Pat. We have a question. We have a question from Pat. She emails us, Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, what are the pros and cons of getting a mammogram after the age of 74?
Okay. Well, the answer is it depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah.
There is a lot of confusion on the part of medical groups in the United States. Certain medical groups will continue to advise mammograms for women past, you know, well past the age of 70. But the vast majority of groups agree that once you've had a series of normal mammograms and you're past a certain age, the need for mammograms, the frequency of mammograms, may decrease. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that women who get breast cancer later in life tend to get less aggressive breast cancer. And I'm talking about past, say, 70 or so. I think the prime ages where women get very aggressive breast cancer is around 45, 50, 55, 60s, early 60s. But beyond that, well, first of all, a person has a more limited lifespan anyway. It's sort of like the same situation analogous to a man who's 86 and gets a diagnosis of prostate cancer. That prostate cancer may be the cancer that kills them at 102, and they might die of, you know, for other reasons before. So to do very aggressive treatment that is life-impairing and affects the quality of life may not be doing the patient a service. And so, you know, of course, the circumstances vary. I mean, if someone has a real strong history of breast cancer in their family, if they've had previous abnormal mammograms, if the mammogram is to make sure that cancer isn't going to come back because they've had previous cancer, you know, that those are exceptions. But, by you know, all too often, women just get lockstep, and men, but to a larger extent, women get lockstepped into unnecessary procedures. You know, there are 80-year-olds getting annual pap smears. There are women with hysterectomies who are getting pap smears, you know, which is...
I think the confusion there is even with a total hysterectomy, I believe in some cases the cervix is left intact.
Right.
And that's the area of the pap smear. So can you shed any light on that?
Well, in some cases, though, and this is documented, is that there are unnecessary pap smears being performed where there is, you know, virtually no cervix, so... I find it inconceivable, but the doctors, you know, go up there, do a scraping, and claim it's a pap smear when actually, with you know, they're looking at, you know, vaginal canal tissue that's closed off. That's not really cervix. So, you know, there really is a need to push back against unnecessary procedures, and there's actually a campaign underway across the board, looking at each and every medical specialty to try and cut down on unnecessary procedures, excess colonoscopies, excess EKGs, excess chest x-rays, so-called routine chest x-rays. Well, in the old days, it used to be you go to the doctor and you get a routine chest x-ray. Well, now that doesn't make sense at all, except perhaps in people who are smokers or who have a specific complaint. And, you know, we have an EKG machine at our office. And we rarely dust it off. And brand new. And, you know, and the gals in the office say, Dr. Hoffman, you got a new toy, but you're not using it. And the reason is because I use it if it's indicated. But to take, you know, each and every patient and do a routine annual EKG on them, that's not a good use of medical resources. And it's actually something that's discouraged now by, you know, more and more commissions are being developed to actually to help us cut medical costs. In the past, it was like, you know, medicine was this great entrepreneurial enterprise where, you know, they would sell the public on, you know, unnecessary screening in an effort to, you know, jazz up their money-making capabilities. And now we're looking at it from the standpoint more of like the European countries where they actually have a lot of guidelines on how frequently can you get certain procedures. You know, in Germany, which is an advanced medical country, far less colonoscopies are done. And the intervals between colonoscopies are longer.
I wonder what their mandate is on mammograms. And
well, here's a differentiation. In the United States, they say basically women over 40 should get a mammogram and younger if there's a reason. In Canada, or just across the border, I mean, you just go across the border. What's different? Is the air different? They start at 50. And we look at the statistics in terms of survival of breast cancer in Canada, and they're really quite similar to what's happening in the United States. I mean, you imagine that similar population, similar diet, similar lifestyle, and that difference doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference in terms of survival. Now, I'm sure there are cases where women from between the interval 40 to 50 got a mammogram, and that may have saved their lives.
Yeah.
But there is something called NNT, number needed to treat. And an NNT means that you might have to screen 500 women to save one woman's life, or it might be even more out of the ballpark, like 2,000 women to save one woman's life. Well, of course, that woman's life is very important, and it, you know, be one thing if it cost, the costs were minimal, and also if the consequences of mammograms were minimal. And the problem with mammograms is that, A, you get a dose of radiation, and if you get like 50 doses of radiation during your life, that's a lot of radiation.
Yeah.
And B, mammograms create a lot of false positives, which just create havoc in a woman's life, because
I think it's
now
greater than 40% false positive.
Very high.
Yeah.
And which then, you know, you get your breast sliced and diced with, mm-hmm. you know, biopsies, needle biopsies, and so on. And that is not inconsequential. So you might say, well, okay, we have to screen because that might save a person's life. And still, these campaigns dumbly suggest, I mean, this, we look at football games over the weekend. For the whole month of October, football teams are playing with pink shoes and pink gloves in order
to
urge
Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Yeah.
Right, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month to urge all women to get their mammograms, when that's simplistic. That really is not the answer. And unfortunately, many of the companies involved in that effort are equipment makers. They make the machines. Or pharmaceutical companies that make the drugs that are used to treat breast cancer,
mm-hmm.
and it's an industry rather than objective medical enterprise, and that's the problem I have with it.
Yep. All right, Pat. That's our answer. That's Dr. Hoffman's answer.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one because we need. Bottom line, we need better tests. We need tests that are. Don't give us so many false positives, and also don't miss the cancers often. And because I wish I had a buck for every woman who's come to see me and has breast cancer, I said, "Well, did you get your annual mammograms, or were you one of these women who said, 'No, I'm not going to get a mammogram'?" And many of these women said, "Yeah, I got a mammogram the year before," and mm-hmm. then I just felt a lump. Oh my goodness! You mean they missed it on the mammogram? Yep, they missed it on the mammogram. Well, it's not a perfect test.
It's not. It's not. And a lot of women complain that, why can't I just have an ultrasound instead of mammogram?
Or thermography, which we get a lot of questions about. And I reviewed mm-hmm. that subject on this program. Thermography is not really comparable. The standardization of thermography machines and the science of thermography is not really that well established. I mean, it does give you a little bit of a purchase or a little bit of a heads up on the presence of cancer, but there's even worse false positives and false negatives with thermography. It's not a good detection tool.
Really?
Yeah.
But what about ultrasound? Because many women will get a mammogram and then they're not able to see everything, they send them for an ultrasound. Why not just send them straight for an ultrasound?
Yeah, let me put it this way.
Let me put it this way.
You know, you drive? Do you drive a car?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you want to go you want to change lanes in the car, you do two things. I mean, they teach you this in driver's school. You flunk a driver's test if you don't do this. You look in the mirror, right? And you see if there's a car in the other lane. But you'll flunk a driver's test if you don't turn your head to one side or another just to make sure that you don't see a car in the blind spot, okay?
Right.
That's a little bit what the ultrasound is like. The ultrasound is like that turning of the head to see if there's a car in the blind spot, because the mammogram is like the mirror that gives you a pretty good idea what's there or not there. But then the ultrasound is double check, and that's done in women who have dense breasts. Dense breasts conceal potential cancer, and if you have dense breasts, fibrocystic breast disease or breast density. By the way, fish oil tends to reduce that. It actually helps the appearance of the breast on mammograms, makes it easier to discern if cancer is present. But then that's what that is.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Okay.
All right, I think we pretty much exhausted that question. This, we could do entire programs on the subject of, you know, whether you should get PSAs, whether you should get mammograms. There's a great book by Dr. Gilbert Welch, W-E-L-C-H, called Overdiagnosis, and I recommend it to people who want to consider this problem of, you know, all the tests that we're subject to, are they really necessary, and explore the controversy in depth, because he does a good job. All right, this is a good point at which to break, and let's stipulate this is part one of this week's Q&A with Layla. We'll come back with more questions. What's coming up, Layla?
What's coming up? What's the difference between poaching, soft-boiling, scrambling eggs, and what oxidizes the cholesterol in there?
Excellent question. All right, we'll take that up in part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.